Taoiseach challenges the opposition to form your own government if you think you can. The hidden impact the cost of living crisis is having on the homelessness crisis. And how do you reframe the Citizens' Assembly on biodiversity as something other than a stitch-up of rural Ireland? All that and more on tonight's Late Debate. Good evening, Philip Boucher-Hayes in for Katie again this evening. Joining us in studio, we have Pat Casey, Fianna Fáil Senator and Shannon Spokesperson on Finance, Paul Donnelly, Sinn Féin TD for Dublin West and Party Spokesperson on Community Development, Craig Hughes, Political Correspondent with the Irish Daily Mail, and joining us on the line from his constituency, Stephen Matthews, Green Party TD for Wicklow and Party Spokesperson for Planning and Local Government. Good evening to all of you. You at home can text us on 51551. Email us on latedebate@rte.ie or tweet to @latedebate_RTE. Well, where once there was 84, now there is 80. Mathematically, only one more vote than the government needs to keep doing business. Is that precarious? Is there in reality a safety net of government gene pool TDs to keep it between the ditches? Could the opposition now form a government if they wanted to? Well, go ahead if you think you're hard enough, was what the Taoiseach challenged them to do today.
I think, first of all, you can rest assured that the government still has a majority in the Dáil and still has a substantial majority in the Shannon. As you pointed out yourself, there's little or no evidence that the opposition parties will be able to come together to form an alternative government. You don't need an election to form an alternative government. You could have formed one together 2 years ago, a left-wing government, and you decided not to. And that hasn't changed.
And with independent TDs circling the government now with generous offers of help in one hand and shopping lists in the other, have we entered that difficult phase in the lifetime of a government? UCC political scientist Dr. Teresa Reedy joins us now. Good evening, Teresa. How are you?
Good night, Philip.
How stable in reality is the government, do you think?
Well, I think the government is pretty stable. I mean, the National Maternity Hospital has been a persistent controversy for almost a decade, and it's moved central stage now. But it's not an existential threat to the government. I mean, it's a kind of important, but it is a part of just government policy. It's not a vote of confidence. It's not a budget. And I think the other thing to say is that these two TDs have wobbled, perhaps is probably the politest way of saying it, before. Nessa Horrigan has already lost the whip briefly. Patrick Costello, rather unusually, actually took a High Court challenge against the EU-Canada trade deal, which was being put forward by the government of which he was a member. So they've both kind of strayed a little. So it won't come as any great surprise to the government parties that they were, concerned about this. And I think the expectation very much is that they will return into the government fold at the end of this. This is a removal of the whip that is temporary. It's not likely to become persistent or sustained and lead to kind of fracturing
in
the long
term. That's one school of thought on this, as you say, that they will be outside but adjacent to the government. The other school of thought here is, though, there's a number of very tricky climate-related votes coming, particularly when we get down to the allocation of sectoral emissions cuts. And there's going to probably be a vote on turf ahead at some stage. That's not going to be easy for not just the two Greens who have been kicked out temporarily now, but for the rest of them as well.
Indeed, but you'd have to suspect that actually in that instance, the Green Party TDs could potentially actually vote with the government. So I think there'll be a degree of negotiation or rolling negotiation over the next number of months. So we know that there are some Green Party TDs that have lent their support to the government quite frequently over the Dáil term, who may be willing to support it in kind of critical votes. But in that specific one, I mean, I think there'll be internal dissent anyway within Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, but this is a case where actually the two TDs that have left are Green Party TDs, and indeed they probably will be able to rely on their support on those items in ways that they might not be able to in others. I think it's also probably important to say, though, that, you know, despite us spending quite a lot of time talking about these things and speculating about governments collapsing, they actually collapse very infrequently. And if we look back over the last 25 or 30 years, very few governments have come undone or come unstuck. And indeed, the much maligned minority administration with the confidence supply agreement that was only supposed to last for 3 years ultimately ended up lasting for 4 years. So, you know, these systems and structures are very much kind of supportive of keeping governments in place for all kinds of other reasons as well.
I heard the Waterford Independent Matt Shanahan on Drive Time speaking to Barry Lenehan earlier on today with a shopping list that would have made Tony Gregory blush, I suspect. Do you think the government's going to have to rely on that kind of support?
Well, there are different ways in which the governments can engage and negotiate with independent TDs. And again, there are lots of modalities in place because we've seen this happening over multiple coalitions over many decades. You know, long shopping lists are perhaps not the best way of approaching the negotiations. I think some of the independent TDs of old have always said that if you go in with one or two discrete items, you're much more likely to see emphasis and interest in those and perhaps see them delivered. Long shopping lists often fall off the side of government tables.
Stay with us, Teresa. I want to get the panel in on this. Craig, you're in there, you know, close to the action. And I know that you political correspondents love to dust down your knife edge votes. But in reality, how does it feel to you? Does it feel as stable as Teresa is suggesting?
It does. There doesn't seem to be any worry amongst the government, senior government members I've been talking to. But if I can be even more cynical than that, I don't think there's too many in Leinster House who want an election, you know, for a number of reasons.
On either side of the House?
Yeah, no, on either side of the House. I think there may be some government TDs who may have already resigned to losing their seat come election time, who will want it to go on as long as possible. You also have the issue of a lot of constituency boundaries going to be redrawn. And I think if a lot of people are going into battle, they'd like to know exactly how their constituency is going to look. So there's a lot of reasons, a lot of cynical reasons outside of what we've been talking about as to why the government won't be coming down.
Stephen Matthews, how are you all in the Green Party this evening?
Yeah, I'd agree with Craig's analysis there. I think government is stable. The political correspondents packed the gallery last night because I think they expected exactly what happened last night. I think it was well flagged in advance. It wasn't a surprise. I think both Nasa and Patrick had on social media flagged that they were not going to vote with government last night. Every politician in there knows the importance of unity and of the whip system, because if you were able to vote any way you wanted at any time that suited you, you know, government would collapse every couple of months. But Patrick and Nasa, they're long-time members. They've made massive contribution to the party. I hope they reapply to join the parliamentary party. My feeling is that they will, and they have a lot more to contribute to the Green Party. But it's not just the Greens. I mean, every political party has its difficulties. We've seen it recently with Labour. We've seen people leave Sinn Féin. We've seen people leave Fianna Fáil. And last night it was the turn of the Greens.
You have a difficult couple of months ahead of you, though, particularly now when it comes to the allocation of sectoral emissions limits, because there would be a feeling in the environmental movement that this government is about to let the agriculture sector off the hook. Do you think that the rest of you still inside the Green Party will be able to hold your noses and vote yes on something that doesn't apportion sectoral emission cuts equally?
Look, it won't be the first time we've had to hold our nose in a vote, you know, but that's the nature of being in a coalition. Until you have your 80 seats for your party, you obviously have to compromise on some things and agree on others. And we negotiated a very strong programme for government with a lot of green influence in it. Those sectoral emissions, those cuts, that climate targets, I mean, that was the driving force for us. That's what's driven me in politics for many, many years. And I think if we achieve the overall cuts that are required in carbon emissions by whatever way the sectoral pie is divided, then that's what we'll do.
I know, but the problem is at the moment you're not going to, Stephen, because the climate action policy doesn't add up to the 51% of cuts that are targeted for 2030. You guys are going to have to vote for something that you know mathematically doesn't make sense.
It's to achieve that 51% by 2030 is the target, and carbon neutrality by 2050. And of course, it's always going to be a challenge. We didn't, you know, we started this way, way too late. You talked about the difficulty of it for the Greens. It's been difficult being a Green for the last 20 years because we've been driving and asking for this action. So the challenge is really steep now, and it's going to be a real challenge for everybody. But agriculture, as much as anybody, is going to be really harshly impacted by the changes that are coming in climate, by the weather changes, by flooding, by droughts. They're going to be really, really disproportionately affected by climate as well. I think agriculture is committed to making those changes, but it is difficult to make those changes. And I've no doubt there will be difficult, you know, it will be really challenging, but we've got to do it. We don't have a choice in this. You don't negotiate with science.
Paul Donnelly. Craig Hughes just called you cynical there. He said that you actually probably don't want to have a go at collapsing the government yet. Is he right? Would you not put table a confidence motion?
No, look, I think you table a confidence motion when you think that you have an opportunity to do it, or if there's something that's really serious that comes along that warrants that. But I think just in relation to the Tánaiste's comments, 2 years ago was a very different place to where we are now. There are a lot of issues that have gotten worse since this government came into power. For example, housing, health, education. I was at a meeting in my constituency where 15 students, it was 200 people, parents, family members, 15 students who haven't got a school placement, who have autism in September. There are a myriad of issues that are facing people now as we speak. And I think, you know, if the Tánaiste wishes to test the fact that we couldn't form a government or the people are not in a different place than they were 2 years ago, well, then go up to the Phoenix Park tomorrow, test that, call a government.
You've read the Constitution. You know that he doesn't have to do that. It's open to you guys to say, have we got the numbers? Yes, we do. Table a no confidence motion, boot them out.
Well, of course, the numbers are not there at the moment. But I do think that if
so
we
he's
did,
right. So the Tánaiste is right,
well,
isn't he?
Well, if we did have an election, then I have no doubts that those numbers will change absolutely, massively and significantly. And I think, as you see, I think it's now 18 polls in a row where people are saying that this government is getting it wrong. They're getting it wrong on health, they're getting it wrong on housing, they're getting it wrong on everything that they have done so far in the last 2 years. And people are saying that, and saying that very clearly to me, they're very clearly to people on the ground. I'm sure they're saying it to people like yourselves every day. You listen to it on the radio, where people are talking about the really dire circumstances that they're in. And that's 2 years in from this government. That's 2016 since we had the confidence and supply. It's 11 years Fine Gael have been in power. They have had their chance. They have had an opportunity to do that. And they have failed absolutely miserably.
Sinn Féin had their chance as well, Paul. Sinn Féin had their chances as well. And
absolutely
they didn't
not.
Take it. They didn't form a government. When the general election was called in 2020, you didn't sit down honestly to try and form a government. You went round the country holding rallies, telling everybody you'd won the election. You haven't been strong on numbers. You're not strong
on
your health.
Well, the irony
numbers.
Of it is that Fianna Fáil. Well, Fianna Fáil refused to sit down with Sinn Féin. Fine Gael refused to sit down with Sinn Féin. We offered.
But she's
to both,
refusing
we
to
offered,
talk to each
sorry,
other. The Green Party
offered,
offered up to bring everybody and sit around a table.
We offered.
And you know that, Paul, because we made genuine offers to you.
Well,
and
you know that, and I think
I could tell,
it could be confirmed here.
I could tell from those that you were not interested.
Well, Sinn Féin offered to sit down with all parties to negotiate, to talk, to come to an agreement. And both Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael refused.
The only parties left, at the end
that's
of the day, the only parties willing
that's the
to
truth.
Form a government
you had 12
were Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael and the Greens.
You had 12 seats.
Okay. And we still have 12 seats, although two of them are outside.
We're almost 20 minutes into this programme. We haven't heard yet from poor old Senator Pat Casey. He has a point here, Paul Donnelly, doesn't he, Pat, that, you know, if there was an election tomorrow, then there'd be quite a few faces that wouldn't be darkening the doors of Leinster House again. So it's in your interests to cling on for as long as you can.
Every election brings changes to the members, and I think there's always a third of the members not re-elected in any general election. So there's always a change of faces. And there is no need for an election at the moment. There's no threat to the current government. The government, as Craig has said, is quite stable and it's not going anywhere. I would completely disagree with what Paul has said in relation to the delivering government when you look at the 2 years that we had coming through the COVID situation. He said no progress has been made on housing. listen, we have 22,000 completions in March, by the end of March this year. We'll have over 26,500 by the end of this year. We've over 33,000 commencement notices in before us, and we're looking at additional planning applications in the region of 40%. So that is or 40,000, that's a huge growth in relation to progressing.
And you've a rocky period ahead of you now, though, don't you? Isn't the parliamentary arithmetic now the kind of thing that ends up corroding and undermining from within any programme for government? You're not going to get your agenda implemented.
I would disagree. I think the government is actually very strong, very focused, and it was a fairly detailed programme for government that was trashed out between three parties. And as Stephen has said,
with these numbers that you're going to end up having to compromise even further, aren't you?
I don't see the three TDs that are whipped at the moment. We have our own Mark McSherry and the two Greens that are whipped. There's nothing to say that they won't vote with the government if it was a vote of confidence call tomorrow morning. I can't see any threat to this government in the near future at all.
Craig, when does the watering down of the programme for government begin?
Well, I think they have enough legroom and enough space to water down already because of what's happened. You know, we've had a pandemic. There's been drastic change since that document was drawn up. So you can move the goalposts already and still get away with it. It's just all about what becomes acceptable to the public.
Teresa, come back in here, please, because you're very far away from us at the moment. What do you make of what you've heard?
Well, I mean, I think that we've had many governments that have had very tight arithmetic. And I think governments losing a vote used to be something quite dramatic in the Irish political system and often marked kind of an important moment in politics. But we've just come out of a minority administration that frequently lost votes. So that whole context of it being a kind of a dramatic event, I think, has really been significantly watered down. So, I mean, I do think that, you know, governments have had tight arithmetic before and managed to govern reasonably effectively to the end of their term. We know the kinds of things that bring governments down tend to be kind of corrosive and usually result in a significant rupture of trust between the party leaders, especially, but all of the component parts of a government. And I don't think that we're in that kind of a space. That's why we often hear that coalition governments are put together on the basis of a kind of no surprises agreement, where there's a lot of sharing of information between the parties, and there are structures put in place to ensure that communication. And I think even in this instance, there was no surprise in the departure of the TDs. It's temporary, and it had been well flagged in advance. So I don't think there's any reason to believe that there is a significant threat to the government. And I would kind of just reinforce the points they're making, that it doesn't make any sense for any of the political parties really to go to the country right now. I mean, particularly the three government parties are not doing terribly well in the polls. Why would they seek an election? And I think we sometimes overstate as well the desire of voters to have elections. I mean, voters go to the polls when they're asked, but when we ask them questions in opinion polls and research studies, they're never terribly enthusiastic about the frequent use of elections. They would prefer to see the parties that they choose get on with the business of governing.
Can I make just a quick point in relation to housing? Because I think that's it's such a massive issue.
Because we're actually going to do that. The entire next 20 minutes of the programme is going to be on housing. We're going to end up repeating ourselves quite a bit. Sorry, excuse me, Paul. So I won't forget that I've cut you short here now. I do want, just before we move off pure naked politics and take an ad break, Craig, the Taoiseach has been out trolling Sinn Féin on CNN, no less, this evening. What did he say?
So the Taoiseach took aim at Sinn Féin's policies. He described them as being anti-West, anti-EU and anti-enterprise. So I guess in capitalist America, being anti-enterprise is probably the worst thing you can say. He also went on to say that they'd be bad for foreign direct investment. And he referenced legacy issues, and he said that the Sinn Féin will have to deal with the past and what he called, quote, horrific atrocities that the Provisional IRA committed. I guess this is kind of, a counterattack to probably Sinn Féin's positive approach during the St. Patrick's Day weekend. You know, they had got a lot of coverage. Mary Lou was in the White House when the Taoiseach wasn't, and they took out ads in American newspapers. So this seems to be a counteroffensive to that. And you'll also notice that the Taoiseach has been bringing this up quite a lot when Sinn Féin have been referencing Israel and Palestine. The Taoiseach has always been saying, well, did you raise these issues in the US when you're talking to your friends there? So this is a long-running ploy of the Taoiseach.
Paul Donnelly, anti-West, anti-EU and anti-enterprise. The floor is yours.
Look, Micheál Martin would say that, wouldn't he? And I think it's just ridiculous. There's absolutely no evidence whatsoever to show any of that. Air policies are very clear. They're open there for everybody to see. We had today even, there was 42 ambassadors or members of embassies around Europe, where Mary Lou and Michelle O'Neill made a presentation today talking about the positive way that we can deal with Europe, with America, with business, talking about the protocol, talking about how we can move forward, how we can deal with all of the problems that we have. So, look, Micheál Martin would say those things, wouldn't he? He's in big trouble, I think, in terms of his own party, in terms of his polling numbers. And he's just repeated a lot of this stuff ad nauseum. When we talk about legacy, I think what he should be talking about is disgraceful action by the British Tory government, who are moving to an amnesty, a blank amnesty. And I think that's something that really he should be talking about, as opposed to let's deal with the legacy issues. There are legacy issues. Everybody recognises that. Everybody acknowledges that. But let's deal with them in the round. Let's deal with them fairly.
He would say that, wouldn't he? It's all very predictable stuff.
Yeah, it is. And in fairness, Micheál Martin, I think, is polling very well as a leader of the Fianna Fáil party, and indeed as Taoiseach, and his numbers seem to go up on every poll in relation to that. So I wouldn't accept that at all. I mean, Sinn Féin have always been anti-EU. You can't deny that.
EU critical. We don't accept
You're anti-EU, you're anti-business, in fairness as well, from the debates I've heard and participated in the Dáil in the previous election and even in the Senate this time. So doesn't what Micheál Martin is saying is factually correct.
And Paul, is there no evidence of this at all, because you cleared the website recently of all those backdated statements? Is that why there's no evidence?
Well, I think, isn't there many people clean up their websites every now and again?
I just asked
the
question when you said.
Well, look,
yeah,
I mean,
it's just coincidental.
I mean,
isn't it?
Every single political party has their policies that are out there. They're well known. They're well versed, and I think, you know, people
are not well able to be scrutinised now, are they?
Of course they are. Everybody can scrutinise us. You know, once you're on the internet, you can never.
If you know how to go and retrieve
But the most important, but the most important, well, the most important thing is where we are in the here and now. And the here and now is that people are listening to Sinn Féin. They're listening to our policies. They're hearing what we're saying. The positive message that we're giving. And they're reflecting that, and they're reflecting that in the polls. Okay. As I said, 16, 17, 18 polls in a row where Sinn Féin have really...
As you said.
Absolutely, and up north
all
as
right.
well.
All right. Patrisa Reedy, thank you very much for joining us this evening. Pat Casey, Paul Donnelly, Craig Hughes and Stephen Matthews are staying with me. I'm going to take a break.
The Late Debate on RTE Radio 1.
Conversation around housing has in recent weeks been about whether developers should be directly supported or not, or what class of home buyer can and can't afford a €400,000 two-bed apartment. But national attention hasn't homed in on what impact the cost of living crisis is having on homelessness. Earlier on, I spoke to Niamh Donnelly, head of services with Merchants Quay Ireland, the homeless charity, who told me who it was they were now seeing lose their homes.
Yes. In recent months, Merchants Quay has started to see a small increase, but a significant increase, of people who are presenting as newly homeless. In the past, we would probably have dealt with people with significant vulnerabilities who are long-term or entrenched homeless. But what we have started to see more of are people who are presenting as a result of relationship breakdown and increased cost of accommodation. And another significant group, which is quite shocking to us, is that pensioners and older people are presenting because they've become unable to afford rent and they're facing eviction in their later years.
This is an entirely different profile of client or person for you to deal with a very different set of needs.
Yes, that's certainly the case. I mean, one of the things I would say is that when people are entering into homelessness, regarding what their other situation is, they are extreme, they are vulnerable. And for these groups of people, they're probably the first time in their lives they've experienced this level of vulnerability. So they don't have the experience of seeking support or the understanding of how to engage with services to get that support.
Reading between the lines of the kind of person that you're talking about who's presenting to you as newly homeless, I would imagine that marital breakdown or end of a relationship is figuring quite high there. But in terms of what they're saying to you, how big a part of the picture do you think the cost of living crisis is?
The cost of living crisis has significantly increased the pressures, yes. So people who possibly have gone through previous relationship breakdowns and have managed to either sustain their accommodation or secure different accommodation are now finding that the cost of fuel, the cost of food, the cost of heating, and the cost of rent are beyond their means.
So it's almost a glaringly simple solution to this problem, really, isn't it? I mean, what these people need is short-term financial dig out.
Short-term financial dig out, but actually also access to rental properties. I mean, regardless of whether we're talking about these newcomers in terms of access to merchants' key services or the people with whom we have long-time experience of working, the underlying problem is a lack of both social or affordable rental property.
And when you take them by the hand through the system and show them how it works, is it working for them?
I mean, the system is quite a drawn out process. So, working with somebody and supporting them to go through a housing application process can take up to 12 weeks. So that in itself can come as a shock. What is working for these groups of people is they have current or recent working records. So they will have the required paper trail. They will have pay slips. They will have proof of identity. They will have previous rental track history. So they're better placed to assemble the paperwork and to process through the system quite quickly. For us, an unintended consequence of that is it actually pushes the vulnerable groups that we've been working with over the years further down the queue in terms of that system of gathering paperwork that's more difficult when you've had a fractured and traumatic life.
If there was an unlimited array of powers sitting before you now, if I made you the responsible line ministers for the day, what would you do?
Magic wand time, I'd build more social housing, but that's going to take time. As you say, in the short term, there are people whose needs could quite quickly be met by financial supports that prevent them becoming homeless. But I think the simple answer is, I think in the last couple of years, when we all grappled with COVID, homelessness went under the radar, but it didn't go away. So what we have to do is apply our minds to rebuilding a social housing stock.
How do you make those people who are recently homeless more, or no, maybe the better way to put it is less unattractive to HAP landlords? Landlords who say, look, I just want an easy life, and somebody who has been in homelessness is probably somebody who is going to present me with issues at some point in time.
Well, there, I think, is one of the challenges. So the newer presenters are going to be a better attraction to landlords. However, what that then does is take housing stock out of the mix for the really vulnerable. I guess in terms of maybe working in the long term, something that local authorities have recognised and are working with the homelessness sector very closely on is actually supporting people within their tenancies to try to prevent default eviction and arrears, so to reduce that what I describe as revolving door of homelessness or eviction, because the more individuals are evicted, the less attractive they become to landlords because of their history.
Niamh Donnelly, Head of Services with Merchants Key Ireland, speaking to me a little bit earlier on. Paul Donnelly, to coin a phrase here, and this is a clumsy one, let's call them cost of living crisis homeless. Are you seeing many people who fall into that category in your constituency?
I think for the last number of months, I think every constituency office will have seen an increasing number of people who we would have never seen before in terms of housing and in terms of recording housing need and housing supports. They are people who are working. They are people who would be of an income that would be over the threshold of the local authorities. And another scandal is that we're waiting 10 years for the income thresholds to be addressed within the local authorities, which means from 2011, they haven't been touched. So there are people who are on the housing list for 10 years, 11 years, maybe have a low paid job, but working away, still under the threshold, then all of a sudden get a small increase in their salary, or they make an increment in their salary. They go over the threshold and now they have no social housing. They're thrown off the social housing list. The Minister has promised for at least 2 years, we've been asking for that review that they've talked about to be addressed, and that still hasn't been done. There's another cohort of people, and I just had recently a person, both people working, they're in a RAS tenancy for 13 years. The landlord is selling the house. They had to move out of that house. And the crazy thing is that a new landlord could come in, could buy that house, and then could release that house back to the council on a long-term lease, whilst that other family who were in that house for 13 years, who were deemed to be socially housed, are now somewhere else. The system needs to change.
Well, it's mad that the system can't see its tenant as an asset rather than a problem.
And the problem is that the government are telling the local authorities you cannot buy that property if a landlord is selling it for a RAS tenant.
Stephen Matthews, are you seeing this cost of living crisis cohort in your constituency in Wicklow?
I am. I would agree with Paul on that. I think we're seeing it across every constituency and we're seeing it across every area. I'd go back even further than that, back as my time as a councillor as well, say around 2018, 2019, I was seeing a lot more housing representations coming to me that traditionally wouldn't have come to me. Housing representations traditionally would have gone to the Sinn Féin councillors or the Fianna Fáil councillors, and, they would have come to more to me on transport and planning and environmental matters. But I was seeing a lot of people approaching me about it, and that's, when we could start to see the real difficulty starting. I think Niamh Donnelly summed it up quite well there in terms of the long-term solution to that is provision of more housing. It is provision of that social housing figures.
Supply.
Supply will only do one thing. It won't necessarily reduce costs unless you oversupply, but at least you'd stabilise the costs there. But the financial supports in the short term are what desperately are needed in order that people can stay in those homes as well. So the government has put forward a lot of cost of living measures recently to try and assist people like that, to try and assist people with the other costs associated with living, the fuel costs. There's been the reduction in the excise duties. There's been the €200 across the board for everybody for the electricity grants. There's been reductions in, say, things like public transport, big reductions in that, reductions in childcare fees. So government is trying to target across the entire cohort of people out there to try and target those most vulnerable, but also to realise that across the board out there, there are people who, as your report said, wouldn't have fallen into this position, are now falling into that position, and we have to target that as well. Conscious of, worried about it. Another cohort that wasn't mentioned is the...
Sorry, you finish your point. I was just about to say, Paul Donnelly, another hang cohort on, please.
it is worrying, is that kind of younger... population, that 20 to 24 sort of age group, there's big increases in that as well, and we really need the supply out there of those single units as well.
Okay, Pat Casey, I read a shocking figure this evening because it suddenly something that I had watched on prime time just put in my mind to say, let's go back and look at the other housing crises and rewind and see how well we did at solving them. The mortgage crisis. I looked at the central bank mortgage arrears figures this evening. There's 27,000 households. That's probably about 90,000, maybe 100,000 people, human beings, who are living with the fear of eviction over their heads because their mortgages are in 2 years or more. The majority of them are 5 years of arrears. We still haven't solved that problem. You guys are all just playing to your own constituencies, aren't you?
No, I think that's a very fair comment at all. And if we can go back to the homelessness and if we can make a comment on that, because I think we're all
Make a comment on that. You still haven't solved the mortgage crisis because you're building houses for a different kind of person as opposed to taking care of the people who are living right now with the fear of eviction over their heads.
Well, I'm not too sure whether they're... the mortgage crisis and what's coming down the road, it will be challenging, and solutions in relation to mortgages and the cost of living and the increase in mortgages will going to be have to be addressed, and there's to try and prevent, as you say, the evictions happen. But just going back to this homeless thing, because I have a keen interest in it, because I sat on the housing committee in the last Dáil, and I did point out, and Niamh has pointed out here, the cohort of people, pensioners, I identified in the last thing as the next potential homeless cohort. And it's beginning to show through now. And we do have to have to act. The long term is supply. We are increasing the supply of social housing. We cannot deny that, whether Paul shakes his head or not. We'll have 10,500 social homes delivered this year. That's 50% of all the houses built this year are social homes. They're facts.
It's not enough.
No.
It is clearly
not
enough.
In all fairness, Paul.
It's clearly not enough.
In all fairness, Paul, I didn't interrupt you.
Well, I'm going to let him interrupt you there.
No.
Make your point, Paul, and then I want you to get you address it, please.
The people who are at the raw end of this have been hearing this for the last number of years. I was a councillor in 2008, and we were warning time and time and time again, we are not building social housing. We are sending people who would previously have got into social housing into the private market through rent supplement at the time. We changed it to HAP. We have various different methodologies, long-term leases, RAS, HAP, all of these different schemes, exclusively sending social housing applicants into the private market, along with the people in the private market who are trying to also get that same property. So for years and years and years, this is not something that crept up. This is not something that we suddenly woke up 3 years ago and decided, my God, this is a crisis. This is something that has been told and warned about year on year on year. And I'll give you a statistic which just came from the department today. 9,825 people accessing emergency accommodation. That's 333 increase. That's 2,800 children, 7,000 adults, 4,000 under the age of 24. That's a 21.89% increase on March 2029. And you're telling me this is working. Your system, your scheme, your housing for all is working.
Okay.
And let me give you another example.
You're throwing enough at the poor man. Let him respond to at least one of those points.
I never made any of them statements. I made it clear fact that we're building 10,500 social houses this year. That is a fact. In the programme for government, we are delivering 300,000 homes. 90,000 of them are social homes. 45,000 are affordable, or cost rental.
So 50%... Do you see the problem here? It's like you're almost speaking two different languages.
In fairness, what we're saying is the reality. We're being honest with people. We're telling them what we can deliver with the restrictions and the confinements that are out there. We can live in magic land and say we'll build these houses overnight. And Sinn Féin are saying they'll build 40-something houses, but they're not saying how they're going to build
them. Let me reframe the whole question, the whole issue to you this way. Your response to this is constantly one of the number of houses that we are building, where you have heard Niamh Donnelly say, well, no, there's actually social issues that the government needs to address here. There's bureaucratic issues that the government need to address here that they don't need to build houses to solve. I've raised the mortgage crisis. That's issues with the banks that you need to get them to address that doesn't need any houses built. Those are the things that you're not talking about, that you're not tackling, that are contributing to the housing crisis.
I'm not denying any of that, but I was just giving some clear facts that are the truth of the facts. There are other measures that can be taken, and I think we've seen it when COVID struck. In the first round of COVID struck. The one thing that happened, at that time, we were over the 10,000 homeless figure. And when COVID impacted, what did you see? you're seeing the short-term rental properties coming back into the rental market, and that alleviated and helped the supply of housing
and here you go again, because my point to you is that when I said at the very outset, you're really only serving your own constituency, your own base, aren't you? You do that and you serve them by talking about the number of houses that you're building, houses that can only be bought by people who have the income to do it, who have money to do it. You're still not addressing those social issues, those issues with the banks, those bureaucratic issues that have been highlighted here.
You know, it is part of the solution. You cannot deny it. I mean, the short-term lettings is having a significant impact in the housing supply. And we all know the homeless figure, in fairness, is at a crisis point in Dublin, where over 70% of all homelessness is actually in Dublin, whereas 30% is across the rest. We've seen studies, and I work with your own colleague, Owen O'Brien, in the Housing Committee, in commissioning that report and doing that report in relation to the short-term lettings. And I think it is a quick win for everybody in relation to trying to address the homelessness. And the provisions of homes at the end of the day for these people is the single most important things. Yes, there's other issues we need to address, but it's all about supply of new homes, supply of voids that's in the system. We've brought back 6,000 voids.
And we're back to the housing figures again.
So, houses are important, I think.
They're not the only solution to the question.
Absolutely. I think there's one point which you've raised, which I agree with you, is on the short term lets. And we're bringing forward a PMB next week, and I'm sure you're going to support us on that, which will ensure that those short term lets that are illegal short term lets. So bear in mind, last week, 436 rental properties. In long-term rental properties in Dublin, there was 2,704 short-term lets. So that's 2,700 Airbnb-type properties that are available. The problem is that the vast majority of them are operating illegally. The housing department, because we've asked the housing department, I've sat with the housing with the planning enforcement in Fingal County Council, they do not have the capacity to be able to manage that system of monitoring those. So a very simple thing we could do is to make it illegal for Airbnb or estate agents or any type of organisation or any of those platforms to advertise any of those without having the proper planning permission for those.
But so you'd anybody, still need enforcement so, there. You would still well, need somebody no, checking
well,
the website. No,
we absolutely. It would make it illegal for those. Absolutely.
And yeah, but somebody would still have to check the website.
Of course.
And, you haven't solved the human resources problem.
It is because it's a much simpler system, because if you are a planning official, you have to physically go out, you have to investigate that individual property. If you're one of these platforms, then this person would have to submit an application, just submit the planning application to you before you would allow them to put it on the platform. Okay. If they don't, then that platform would be fined every day.
We haven't heard from Craig in a while here, sorry.
I do think it's a bit ironic, though, in a sense, Paul, that you would want put more faith in local authorities to do something as significant as that. That you're saying that they can't even clamp down on Airbnb.
Let's give them the capacity to do it. Happy days. I would absolutely do that.
The whole principle of the Sinn Féin housing ideology is to have local authorities doing it. So if Sinn Féin were in government in the morning and they can't even, you know, look after illegal Airbnbs, how can they build all the houses? How will they have the capacity to build all the houses that you want them to do?
I think there's a simpler way of doing it.
Could I come in there, Philip?
Because not only is it a simpler way of doing it, but there's a simple way of doing it, which is to put the onus on the platform.
To hear Stephen's trying to come in.
Yeah, sorry. Just could I come in on that there as well? And I mean, I've seen Sinn Féin voting against social and affordable housing all across Dublin.
They voted against. Name one. Name one.
Bray and your two councillors voted against 26 social affordable housing, approved housing body units led by the local authority. You voted against it. It's on the record. Your housing spokesperson actually apologised for it. But we're seeing this around the country. Now, your spokesperson also said he doesn't want the Land Development Agency to build houses. So now you won't support local authorities. You won't support affordable houses.
That's untrue. Absolutely
Who
untrue.
Who is going to build
what
these
is
houses?
Affordable? Can I ask you what your view of affordable is?
You have a major issue.
What's your price?
issue. You have a major issue with private investment in housing as well. I don't know where you're going to come up with the figures
There's
are a range of measures out there. One thing that's been hugely ignored out there is the amount of dereliction and vacancy. And you're speaking of private members' bills. I have one going through at the moment which seeks to really address the amount of dereliction and vacancy that's out there. That really sits well with our town centres first policy. It really sits well with bringing life and living back into our town centres. It really fits the bill for those
because I need to take another break ahead of another very, very pressing crisis.
The Late Debate on RTE Radio 1.
It is National Biodiversity Week. We have a Citizens' Assembly up and running. Almost instantly, urban-rural battle lines were drawn there. Journalist Ella McSweeney told the Assembly that the countryside was at risk of becoming a ghost land. Roscommon TD Michael Fitzmaurice said the Assembly ran the risk of being another stitch-up of rural Ireland. So, has another front opened up in the culture wars, or can a new narrative be set here? Stephen Matthews, it's actually 3 years ago this month that the Dáil declared, a climate and biodiversity emergency. How have we addressed the biodiversity emergency in that time?
Today, actually, we had a lot of statements in the Dáil on the new National Parks and Wildlife Service and a massive ramp up of that service, and full credit to Minister Malcolm Noonan. And there was absolute cross-party support for that and recognition of the tremendous amount of work to bring that service up to the level that's required to work on protecting and preserving our
environment. You brought the funding back up to where it was in 2008, and arguably in 2008 the National Parks and Wildlife Service was under-resourced.
It was, but you know, when you're bringing any organisation up to funding which has been depleted of resources and staff, you don't just pile a whole load of money on them, you do it incrementally. This is over a number of years, and it puts in place a really, really strong basis for the National Parks and Wildlife to do that really important work that we know that they need to do. The Citizens' Assembly on Biodiversity, I don't believe that this is just another wedge between rural and urban Ireland. Our environment and our biodiversity doesn't recognise urban and rural borders. You know, we depend on a healthy environment in balance, that intricacy, that balance of nature that we have out there. So I don't believe it drives a wedge between rural and urban Ireland. Many people in Northern Ireland depend on biodiversity. Farmers depend on biodiversity. They depend on healthy biosphere out there. And they don't want to destroy it either. They don't want to damage water quality. They don't want to deplete soil. They don't want to contribute to excess nitrates in our water. And I think we'll see that action. We'll see the recommendations coming from the
Assembly.
Citizens' Assembly. But from what I can see cross party, there's absolute support and recognition that every and all action has to be taken. This is a real emergency.
Okay, Pat Casey, government policy on agriculture is one of growth and expansion, because that's something that serves the needs of Kerry Group, of Glanbia, of ABP. These are all companies that are high volume, low margin businesses. And when you're a high volume business, it means you have to have intensive farming. You have to be coming up with a lot of produce to service those machines. And that doesn't leave an awful lot of space for nature, does it? You can't really address the biodiversity crisis until you address the entire business model.
Well, and that is a challenge when it comes to the agricultural sector, specifically in relation to the farmers and the income. Trying to sustain a living out of farmers is going to be a challenge. And I think the programme for government and the plans and how we're going to attack this in relation to Minister Charlie McConnell went around to every county, visited every mart, met the farmers to discuss the forthcoming CAP programme, to discuss the measures where they could introduce sustainable measures that would help both biodiversity and indeed farming in relation to being sustainable into the long-term future and not playing into the hands of the big meat producers.
Is the mechanism not there already to do all of this? Because so many of the smaller to medium farmers are basically living off their single farm payment as it is already. why not link that payment to greater biodiversity enhancing measures?
And that's where I think in pillar two of the CAP programme, where the minister has the flexibility, and that is exactly what he's talking about doing. He's talking about introducing schemes that will supplement the farmer and also help biodiversity across the... And he spoke, openly spoke at all the MART meetings in relation to... That is how he's trying to... make farming.
But you're right. He absolutely does have discretion to move money from pillar one to pillar two. He can do that. Why hasn't he done
it? No, he doesn't. In fairness,
that was something that was
in relation to the cap figure in relation to pillar one. He has flexibility in relation to pillar two and what schemes he can use in relation to helping biodiversity and helping farmers create a sustainable income that they can survive off the land as well. And he has that flexibility, but not in pillar one.
Paul Donnelly, would you accept that Malcolm Noonan has beefed up the human resources and the budget for the National Parks and Wildlife Service, which had been pretty much more or less ignored for the last decade?
I think there's no doubt about it. Biodiversity is something now that I think that everybody has become much, much more aware of. You know, I sat through the County Development Plan. If anybody has ever sat through a County Development Plan or worked through them, they are long, tedious and difficult pieces of work. And even in a county like Fingal, it is incredible to see the amount of work that has gone on in relation to biodiversity and to future-proofing, I suppose, what we have, holding what we have, but also building on what...
And tedious meetings about development plans are absolutely useless unless you have an agency that can enforce biodiversity, and the National Parks and Wildlife Service wasn't resourced to do that properly. Do you accept that this government has done a good thing in beefing it up again?
Well, there's no doubt about it. We need an extremely strong National Parks and Wildlife Agency. There's no doubt about that. And I think there's a very interesting case that's going on at the moment that Lynn Boylan is looking into, where the OPW disturbed a bat roost, destroyed one. And the evidence is there to say that, but the National Parks...
Am I hearing agreement from Sinn Féin that they're supporting a government action here? I think am I hearing that correctly?
In fairness,
I think Eoghan Brin spoke very positively today on
absolutely,
it as well.
And I think there's no doubt about
with him
it.
As well.
I think
a lot of parties are recognising it's something I've been marching on for 20 years and knocking on doors, you know, and now it's just great to see that everybody recognises, are willing to take action. So we need to see that cross-party action.
Yeah, okay, but Stephen Matthews, the same point to you that I put to Pat Casey, is the entire business model of high-volume, low-margin farming and food production not one that is completely inimical to saving the biosphere?
I speak to a lot of farmers now, and they say that, you know, we are a pin of our collar here. We're trying to produce so much. We're trying to get so much out of the land. We're pressured from every side. We're not getting great value for our product here, even though it's a class product that they're producing. It really does have to look at that farm model as well. And we need to look at how we can supplement farmers to farm closer to nature and pay them to protect nature. You know, for farmers to protect nature is protecting it for all of us, for future generations, for every one of us that lives in this country.
Can I make just one very quick point. I think we have to be really careful in terms of biodiversity not being a sacrificial lamb for climate action. And so we need to ensure that when we do things that in relation, for example, wind farms, that we don't damage the biodiversity whilst at the same time, you know,
saving the climate.
Paul, you were doing well, but you're objecting to a solar farm down in Tipperary now. And there's no issue with that. You can continue farming. We've put a solar farm
all
into
right,
Wicklow.
Thank you all very much.
Up to that point.
Stephen Matthews, thank you. Paul Donnelly, thank you. Pat Casey, thank you. Craig Hughes, thank you very much. Sean Marram was our broadcast coordinator. Research was by Andrew Fleming. Liam Mullen was on sound. Tonight's programme was produced by the series producer, Penny Hart. Carl Murray is on the way with Late Date. But first, it is over to Michael Corcoran on the Sports Desk.